it. And actually, I'll tell you a secret. I think I learned physics in here, probably. Would that make sense? a very long time ago. In the meantime, and the reason I've been asked this afternoon is that 12 years before I came back to Cambridge, just a couple, 3 years ago actually, for 12 years I was chief executive of Oxfam. And therefore, I spent a lot of my time actually thinking about food security, and of course, food security most particularly for poor people. And I'm going to sort of go quite fast through some of the issues that there are for poor people about food security. But the first thing I'm going to do is just run you through the statistics. Now, this may reappear, but as I'm first off, I thought I'd better set the scene. Where we are now in terms of global food security is that there are nearly a billion people who are undernourished. These are FAO statistics. And that's undernourished in calories and doesn't take into account all the different nutritional needs that there might be as well. The biggest absolute numbers in South Asia, but the highest proportion in sub-Saharan Africa. But the key thing is, at this moment, if it was properly distributed in terms of, you know, just even those calorific numbers, there would be enough food for everyone in the world at this moment. If you, though, even, you know, you leave the middle classes doing all the overeating that they're doing, as Chris mentioned, and, you know, the amounts of meat and so on, keep the diets the same, you would still only need to have an increase of 1% in food production to make sure that the world could be fed. So that doesn't sound, you know, particularly great and particularly difficult. The real difficulty, of course, is when you look at the 2050 statistics, where FAO says that we're going to need at least 70% increase in food production for the 9 billion people that there are going to be there then, and even that number keeps changing and moving up a bit. So the first thing is, how do we get that food that we're going to need then? And I'm going to do it sort of first without thinking quite about the implications of climate change, and then add a bit on at the end about, you know, how climate change makes this even more difficult. But the first thing, of course, as has been mentioned, is to stop food waste. In Europe, it's something like 100 kilograms per person a year that is actually of food that's thrown away. I mean, just amazing amounts of food that get wasted in the developed world. And of course, in the poorest countries, food is being wasted very heavily there too, but for quite different reasons. It's about food rotting on the way to markets because there's no refrigeration, or very poor storage for grains and all those sorts of things. So you could immediately do an enormous amount just by doing those things. I'm not going to go into this population question, though I'm very happy to talk about it if it comes up in questions, but just to stick to food for the moment. The two big ways, though, to move on in terms of agricultural food production, I mean, one is, of course, to just straightforwardly increase agricultural production. The second one is actually to fix the global food system to make it much fairer for people so that they can actually get food. Now, every time you talk about increasing consumption, especially if you read The Economist or something, immediately the answer comes out, we need big farms. We need to get rid of all these small farmers, go to big farms, and there you have Brazil on the right, and Brazil has done very well on the whole out of big farms. The real difficulties about this are that if you take all those small farmers off their land right now, you will have enormous runs on the cities. And as you know, there's enormous migration to the cities already. And this is just something that will make it even worse. We know how difficult it is to have services in cities, sewage, education, health, all those things just there, you know, to be provided for more and more population. And there is a great incentive, I think, in the world to make sure that small farmers, for the moment, can keep producing and producing more. In my time in Oxfam, we were very clear that we didn't think this would last forever. But actually, to push people off the land now is just a disaster, given what is, you know, what is already going on. The other negative on the large farms, of course, is the amounts of fertilizer-type inputs that big farms use, etc. So there is a case for making sure that small farmers around the world, of which there are 1.5 billion of them, do better, can produce more. And they're not, contrary to all the, you know, the sort of, you know, the popular view about it, highly inefficient. Actually, they are pretty efficient, but much more could still be done. So the question is, well, why haven't we been doing this? And this is political, of course, because let me just give you the statistics. Back in 1983, aid for agriculture was 20% of all aid that was going out to the poorest countries. By 2006, it was 3.7%. If you listen to that, you will realise how little has been done to really try to improve agriculture in the poorest countries. And yet it is very obvious what things could straightforwardly help, never mind all the science and technology that you might talk about in this room. But, you know, of course, extension support, agricultural extension support to get help people with better practices, especially women. Women, small farmers, who are 70% of Africa's small farmers, get very, very little, under 5%, it's estimated, of actually extension support, for example. You need money for some sort of fertilizer, but largely, we hope, organic. That's what you need to be able to do. You need rural roads. You need drip irrigation. And above all, you need farmers to have the ability to own their land so that they can actually get loans for doing something to actually invest in their lands. The thing that, I mean, of course, there's loads and loads you could say about productivity, and I'm sure people in the room will, but those are some of the key things. But the other key thing I want to really draw out is that what really helps small farmers is to get organised. If you have cooperatives or production companies or whatever, you can really bring loads and loads and loads of farmers together. And here, actually, is an example of a cooperative in Ethiopia where there were 9,000 women in this beekeeping cooperative. Great thing to do because you could do it near the house, looking after children and so on. And they were producing honey, as you can see. And I don't mean honey in little garden party pots. What they were producing was vast vats of honey that were being exported to the French bakery market, actually. So you can turn these small farmers into groups of people who really are substantial and can negotiate into either, you know, big markets in the sense of physical markets or markets in other countries, or can actually work with some of the major food companies who are prepared more and more to buy from organised small farmers. They can't deal with 9,000 farmers. We work with Unilever in Azerbaijan on growing onions for North Stock Cubes, but you needed 1,000 farmers to come together producing those onions to make any sense of it for a company like Unilever. So producer organisations, marketing organisations, all of those sorts of things are really helpful to people. Now, that's the sort of some of the positives you can do about this. And then some of the negatives are the things that you have to stop. I mean, I might say that the first one, of course, is really dealing with these northern subsidies that are still going on and end up with dumping of food into, you know, the poorest countries. But the big issue that's really going on at the moment is land grabs. Many, many people are taking land because they know this is the future. Land is going to be very, very scarce, land for agriculture. Different people are doing it for different reasons. Some people are just buying up land, particularly in Africa, just to hold because they know its value will increase. Some countries, sovereign wealth funds, are going into Africa and getting land in order to feed their own people. The Gulf states, Saudi Arabia in particular. And what if you think about what they're actually doing, they're actually buying water. It may sound silly, but that's what's going on. They buy land, make sure that it's productive, and then they ship the food back to Saudi Arabia. And what you're actually shipping is all the water that, you know, landed on those in that area. So you've got lots of different companies, as I say, sovereign wealth funds, going into countries particularly like Africa and just taking on land. Now, often that's done with governments. And, you know, the people who actually have a customary use of the land, that is ignored completely. The rules that are in the sort of global system now say you have to have informed consent from the people on the land and you must compensate them. Now, this is a picture of Uganda, and I think there's somebody in here from Uganda, where a British company doing forestry forced 22,000 people off their land in Uganda. They were told by the government not to worry about compensation. The government would do it. But in fact, of course, the government didn't do it. We ended up in a massive, long case, actually, with the involved with the communities. But from an Oxfam point of view, we weren't just trying to help the communities. We were trying to point out that the International Finance Corporation, the World Bank, the butt of the World Bank, who were actually funding this company, were breaching their own rules, as was HSBC, the bank. HSBC was sitting on the board of this company, and that's what we were trying to demonstrate. It turned out to be an incredibly difficult thing to campaign about, because once we got involved with the World Bank, the World Bank Ombudswoman got involved to negotiate between the communities and the World Bank. And while you're in that negotiation, you're not allowed to have any media activity whatsoever. So all my poor campaigners were desperate to get out there and put little bits on outside every HSBC bank to put a little bit outside saying land taken or something. And they were stopped from doing that. We couldn't do all of that. But I laugh at that. But this is, you know, this is very serious stuff. I mean, this is horrendous, the things that are happening in the way land is taken. And, you know, as you see, just bulldozers going straight through and just destroying absolutely everything. And quite often there are lives at stake in all of this too. So the doing something about land grabs is an absolutely central thing. And the reason, of course, for the land issue is, back to what I said before, it is about all this investment as well that farmers can make if they have collateral to say that they own this land. So then there's that's one bit. The other bit I want to sort of emphasise is this thing about the whole food system and who actually owns it and who knows what. Now, I mentioned at one end, you've got 1.5 billion producers, but you've just got 4 firms who are actually dealing with pretty well all the inputs that are needed that are bought for agriculture. That's an enormous, not quite monopoly, but monopolistic position to be in, to control prices, to decide where the technology is going and so on. So very significant issues there. The one with the red circle round is circle because actually 3 major companies control something like 90% of the global grain trade. Fascinating. The key thing there is it is not transparent what they are holding, where it is, what they intend to do with it. When we went through the global food price crisis in the sort of, you know, about 2006-08, nobody knew where all the grain was in the world because those companies were holding it. So there's a big call for being really transparent about where those grain stocks are and so on. You come to the left-hand end and you get more to the area where it is actually easier to try to shift some of the behaviours. But you'll see again, you've got some companies who have got very, very large control of different parts of the food market. And we need to understand that and understand what they're doing. And the big issue there, of course, is not having a race to the bottom in terms of the price that ultimately gets paid to poor farmers at the other end in what you're doing. So, but this is the area where consumers can start acting. And you've seen consumers starting acting when in people who've gone into the fair trade movement, you know, the massive increase in coffee fair trade purchase by consumers in particularly Europe and America. Now, I'm not saying fair trade is the answer to everything, but there are signals that consumers can give to companies that actually really make them take notice about what they're doing. And that's some of the campaigning that Oxfam was very heavily involved in. But I do think we all ought to think about these food systems and how they work and how you do get more control for the needs of the world on these, and not letting just a very small number of companies actually, you know, in a sense, hold us hostage on what is happening to all our food. Now, I want to move to that a little bit, just a bit more about climate change, because I said it wouldn't be very difficult, at least for now, to get enough food. It's going to be more difficult by 2050. Of course, the real problem is it's going to get even more difficult as time goes on, and this was only up to 2030. This is research in 2010. The solid lines are the estimated increase in prices on all those items up to 2030. The hatched ones are what those increases in prices look like once you add in the effects of climate change. Now, you can see, you know, some really dramatic increase in prices. The real problem, of course, for poor people isn't just the sort of average price that we are thinking about here. If you're spending, as poor people do, 70% of their income on food, and the food price doubles, you have really had it. Now, for us, of course, you know, that increase, some particular bit of food, if one bit of that food increased in our lives, it would be a few percent of our income. We could actually manage it. For poor people, they absolutely cannot do that. You know, that is why you get into these huge problems when you get to food price increases. Poor people just simply cannot then afford, you know, to buy the food that there is around. And of course, this makes it more difficult because of the particular areas where things happen in. And most particularly, of course, the number of extreme weather events, because that's the bit that actually really makes it very difficult in geographic terms for where the food is and which people are being affected. And of course, once again, the poorest people are absolutely being affected by the, just in case you don't know, the number of extreme weather events doubled between 1990 and I think 2005. Now, extreme weather events are both drought and they are the rains, the heavy and persistent rains. The numbers of people being affected by that now are huge. Seeing the Pakistan High Commission there, I remember being in Pakistan on the day the floods came in 2010, and no idea that it was going to mean that 14 million people were displaced. Just huge numbers that happen. And I'll tell you, I heard just yesterday, actually, that at this very moment, there are 60 million people in Africa today who are affected by the current drought. And I've hardly heard about that on the TV or radio at all. Now, they're just very, very large numbers because of the extremes of the way the weather is changing, as we assume, a result of climate change. The issues, I mean, of course, for us all, not just for poor people, are that what is going to happen to food production with climate change. I mean, it's estimated that if you don't take into account any adaptation, if we manage to keep at the 2 degrees centigrade increase in global temperature, you still drop yields by 0 to 2% every decade. Now, if that, and actually that's not so bad for some of us because, you know, the different temperate climates do slightly better. You get to 3 to 4 degrees increase in temperature and we've all had it, basically. The food production globally then is dramatically affected in every place at all latitudes, really. So what have we got to do? Well, clearly, I think it's a picture of a drought in the Sahel from that one. We have first of all got to obviously deal with climate change, and it's good that at least there is some progress from the Paris talks. The worry I have is that they still, of course, don't keep us to 2 degrees centigrade, never mind 1.5, which we'd all like. But the real thing for me is, I'm sure one day the world is going to have to do what it has to do about climate change. For me, the issue is how many poor people are going to have to suffer through all that before we ever get to that point where we notice it so much that we can't cope with it and therefore do something. Meanwhile, of course, and I'm just coming to the end now, a couple of slides here, what we have to do in the meantime is to help poor people to cope. I'm sure other people will talk about making agriculture itself more sustainable, but other things are about helping people survive in these situations. This was actually my very last Oxfam visit to Bangladesh, which is down, and that visit was down on the coast where sea level rise is going on very strongly. But the point I want to make here is, this is the local disaster management women's group. And it is women's groups all across that patch of land that are saving lives in cyclones. We used to have tens of thousands of people die in cyclones. Hardly any die in cyclones now, even though it's actually got much worse. The disaster management of putting things on higher ground, taking your pots up, dry goods, and actually having very fast communication systems now with mobile phones is saving people's lives there. And Bangladesh has been brilliant at actually managing to do that, with a lot of help from the international community. So it is about those women doing that. And this is the other one, which is thinking about how you keep things going. And it relates to a point that Chris made about, well, is it food that people need or what is it? And more the aid agencies have become very clear that mostly when you have food price crisis, it's actually money that people need. That's not always the case. There are places where there is absolutely no food and you can't ship food in. But that is pretty rare, actually, and more likely to take place in refugee camps and so on, where you move them to somewhere quite different. More and more, though, the issue is to get the markets going, to get the traders actually bringing in the goods from another region, from another country to where people are, but then making sure that poor people have the money to actually buy that food when it comes in. We did that in Somalia, for example, where we, first of all, paid traders. We gave traders enough money to bring their first load in, and also the people were given money to be able to buy, and then it set that whole thing rolling. This is a lovely thing in Turkana. I always describe this as I have seen the future, and it's in Turkana. We were giving out money, or at least the man from Equity Bank was giving out money, who Equity Bank won a global award, actually, for good banking. He comes up from the regional capital once a month. We've assessed the community with the community, and people are, have been allocated to what they should get. What you do, though, is you come in and you have your smart card and you put it in his machine, you put your thumbprint on, it tells you how much you get, and the man gives it to you. And you can't do that in England, you know, and that's why I say there are ways that we can do different things in places like Africa and do them differently. But don't let's forget climate change and what it's doing to poor people. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. A splendid, detailed and yet overview. Questions for Barbara?
There's one right up at the top there.
Charles.
I was very interested in what you were saying about smallholder farmers.
Yes.
And about not taking people off the land too quickly.
Yes.
And given that there's some wonderful exceptions to some of the examples you gave, total tax collection can be really low in smallholder farmers. It's getting worse the more people stay on the land. How great a priority you thought investing in rural economies and in the small towns, one of the big negatives you did.
Yeah.
Have vibrant jobs that can pull people off the land to allow greater investment and to allow the virtuous purpose of increasing productivity.
Yeah. Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I agree with you. I mean, I think you've got to do things at all these levels, actually. You can do more at the local, you know, the small farmer level. You can do better in the cities, in you know, in terms of all the development of, you know, enterprise. But I'm still on.
No, you're wrong.
I'm on. But you do need that middle part. Interestingly, when I was in that Bangladesh situation, it's the first time I've ever felt that people could absolutely not live where they were living anymore because of the salt in the water, basically. And instead, though, of actually doing exactly what you're saying, moving people out to small towns and getting those going, it was just leaving it to the people who were eventually all migrating to Dakar, which is really appalling. So some really good planning in these places would be an enormous help to make sure you're doing that at all levels. But also the enterprise of, you know, putting money in so that people can get started on new businesses, incredibly important too. It's just so disparate, it's so hard to do this across large volumes, large areas.
Thank you. Another question? In the middle, which is probably the hardest to get the microphone to. Charles, I should have asked you to introduce yourself and also to introduce yourself and where you're from. In front of you, Will, put your hand up here.
I'm a local food producer. I was interested, you said on the one hand that there is enough food at the moment and it's more a matter of distribution and being able to buy food and... but then you said there had to be a 70% increase in food over the next few years. Would you say it is 70%? Because I think that number is sort of being used by many big agricultural companies and so on. They're always talking about how many people we have to feed, but they don't talk about food waste and distribution and finance.
Yeah, I mean, that number comes from the Food and Agriculture Organization, you know, through a lot of research and a lot of analysis. But of course, I mean, it's probably not right, you know, in any absolute sense, but there's certainly got to be quite an increase in food production just because of the actual volume of population. But if you take population increase, you take the increase in the middle class, who are likely to eat more meat than they have now, just as we did, then you start seeing why you need, you know, that amount. You've also taken quite a lot of the land off to do biofuels, which, as we know, the first generation have not been very helpful at helping climate change at all, but they have used a lot of the land. I mean, it was estimated in the food price crisis, I think, that 30% of the price rise could be attributed to having taken out so much land in America for biofuels. You know, so things are happening in these systems, and that is FAO's best estimate, I think. I mean, as I say, I think that number of 9 million is now up, you know, up to, I think we're now nearly at 10 million that people are anticipating for 2050. So we know the population's going to increase. So it's clear you've got to have some increase in food production. But, you know, we ought to be doing the very best we can by making sure we don't waste food on the way.
One final quick question for Barbara. Middle there, the red microphone is on its way. And if you could introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, my name is Olga Ballard, and
speak, lollipop.
Sure. Perfect. And currently I work in international bank. My question is, you've mentioned that countries like Saudi Arabia, when they're buying land in Africa, they're essentially buying water. And I spend a considerable amount of time in California as well, where it's a very big issue, the water usage rights, in terms of the amount of water that's going to agriculture. And as we're thinking about the crisis that eventually is going to hit us, do you think water is maybe more important than food at some point? And how do we manage water availability and food availability, especially in places like Africa, where both are pretty scarce?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I don't know whether one's more important than the other. You certainly, absolutely, they're both absolutely incredibly significant. And of course, as you say, the water question is both we need water to drink and water for our daily lives, and we need water to actually grow the crops as well. So the whole thing about water management, you know, just you know, trying to be sparse and, you know, as we can with water, which is why the drip irrigation is so much better. You know, the water collection of rainwater, etc., is incredibly important. But it's also, of course, incredibly important for the way companies use water and whether it's cleaned up and so on, and not least, what's going to happen with climate change and the massive glacier melt and what happens to water there when you're ending up back in the sea. So, I mean, we do have some very, very big issues around water too, and they intersect, as you say, with the food crisis.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Barbara and the questioners again. And the first question, I truncated Charles Godfrey, of course, from Oxford. So. When